down unless their fleet was reinforced. But 2 days after Pillow and Randolph were abandoned, he discovered, in the most shocking way, that it had indeed been reinforced. Back in March, after years of failing to interest the Navy in his theory, an elderly civil engineer named Charles Ellett Jr. wrote and sent to the War Department a pamphlet applying the formula force equals mass times velocity squared to demonstrate the superiority of the ram as a naval weapon, particularly in river engagements, which allowed scant room for dodging. Stanton read it and reacted. He sent for the author, made him a colonel, and told him to build as many of the rams as he thought would be needed to knock the rebels off the Mississippi. Ellett got to work at once, purchasing and converting suitable steamers, and joined the ironclad fleet above Fort Pillow on May 25th, with 9 of the strange-looking craft. They carried neither guns nor armor, since neither had any place in the mass velocity formula. Nor did they have sharp dog-tooth prows, which Ellett said would plug a hole as quickly as they punched one. All his dependence was on the 2 formula components. Velocity was assured by installing engines designed to yield a top speed of 15 knots, which would make them the fastest things on the river, and mass was attained by packing the bows with lumber and running 3 solid bulkheads, a foot or more in thickness, down the length of each vessel, so that the impact of the whole rigid unit would be delivered at a single stroke. Engines and boilers were braced for the shock of ramming, and the crews were rivermen, whose courage Ellett tested in various ways, getting rid of many in the process. Perhaps his greatest caution, however, was shown in the selection of his captains. All were Pennsylvanians like himself, and all were named Ellett. 7 were brothers and nephews of the designer commander, and the 8th was his 19-year-old son. Anxious to put force equals mass times velocity squared to work, the thin-faced, lank-haired colonel was for going down and pitching into the rebel flotilla as soon as he joined up. But Flag Officer Davis had learned caution at Plum Run Bend. In spite of the fact that both sunken ironclads had been raised from their shallow graves and put back into service, the fleet was still under strength, 3 of its 7 units having returned to Cairo for repairs. "No matter," Ellett said, "he and his kinsmen were still for immediate action, with or without the ironclads." But Davis continued to refuse the concurrence Stanton had told the colonel he would have to have in working with the Navy. The Confederates in Memphis, knowing nothing of all this, had assumed from reports that the new arrivers were some kind of transport. They relied on the guns of Forts Pillow and Randolph, or if the batteries failed to stop the Yankees, there was still the 8-boat flotilla which had given them such a drubbing 3 weeks back. Moreover, as at New Orleans, the keels of 2 monster ironclads, the Arkansas and the Tennessee, had been laid in the city's yards. The former, having been launched and armored up to her main deck, was floated down to Vicksburg, then towed up the Yazoo River for completion in safety after the fall of Island 10. But the latter was still on the stocks, awaiting the arrival of her armor. Like the city itself, she would have to take her chances that the enemy would be stopped. Those chances were considerably thinned by the evacuation of Corinth and the 2 forts upriver. It now became a question of which would get there first, a sizable portion of Halleck's Grand Army or the Federal fleet. The citizens hoped it would be the latter, for they had the gunboat flotilla to stand in its way, while there was absolutely nothing at all to stand in the way of the former. They got their wish. At dawn of June 6th, 2 days after Fort Pillow was abandoned, the ironclads showed up, coming around the bend called Paddy's Hen and Chickens, 4 of them in line abreast just above the city, offering battle to the 8 Confederate gunboats. The people turned out in tens of thousands, lining the bluffs for a grandstand seat at what they hoped would be a reenactment of the affair at Plum Run Bend. The first shot was fired at sunup, and they cheered and waved their handkerchiefs as at a tableau, when the southern gunboats, mounting 28 light cannon, moved out to meet their squat, black, bug-shaped northern opponents, mounting 68, mostly heavy. Ellet had his rams in rear of the ironclad line of battle. When the first shot was fired, he took off his hat and waved it to attract the attention of his brother commanding the ram alongside his own. "Round out and follow me. Now is our chance," he cried. Both boats sprang forward under full heads of steam and knifed between the ironclads, whose crews gave them a cheer as they went by. Ellet made straight for the Colonel Lovell, leader of the Confederate line, and when she swerved at the last minute to avoid a head-on collision, struck her broadside and cut her almost in two. She sank within a few minutes, brief, conclusive proof of the relation between force and mass times velocity squared. Meanwhile, his brother had accomplished something different. Striking for the General Price, which held her course while the General Beauregard moved to her aid by converging on the ram, he darted between the two, which then collided in his wake. The General Price lost one of her side wheels, sheared off in the crash, and while she limped toward bank out of the fight, the ram came about in a long, swift curve and rammed the Beauregard at the moment the rebel's steam drum was punctured by a shell from one of the ironclads. She struck her colors. Four of the remaining five did not last much longer, and none ever managed to come to grips with an adversary. Montgomery's little rebel, the only screw steamer of the lot, took a shell in her machinery, then went staggering into the Arkansas bank where her crew made off through the woods. The Jeff Thompson was set afire by a Federal broadside. The Sumter and the Bragg, like the flagship, were knocked into bank by the Dahlgrens. The whole engagement lasted no longer than the one at Plum Run Bend, which it avenged. One Confederate was sunk beyond raising, two were burned, four were captured, and in time became part of the fleet they had fought. Van Dorn, the only survivor, managed to get enough of a head start in the confusion to make a getaway downriver. Two of the rams gave chase for a while, but then turned back to join the celebration. The cheering was all on the river, where the rams and ironclads anchored unopposed, not on the bluffs, where the cheers had turned to groans. Smoke had blanketed the water. All the spectators could see was the flash of Union guns and the tall paired stacks of Confederate steamboats riding above the murk. Pair by pair, in rapid order, the crown top chimneys disappeared. The deep sympathizing wail which followed each disaster, one who heard it wrote, went up like a funeral dirge from the assembled multitude, and had an overwhelming pathos. When the sun-dazzled smoke finally cleared away, they saw that their flotilla had been not only defeated, but abolished, and they turned sadly away to await the occupation which the Corinth retreat had made inevitable anyhow. There still was time to burn the Tennessee, sitting armorless on the stocks, and this they did, taking considerable satisfaction in at least making sure that she would never be part of the fleet whose destruction had been the aim of her designers. It was bitter, however, to surrender as they did to a 19-year-old medical cadet, Colonel Ellet's son, who landed in a rowboat with three seamen and a folded flag, the Stars and Stripes, which presently he was hoisting over the post office. Later that day, the two regiments Pope had left behind marched in for the formal occupation. Thus was Memphis returned to her old allegiance. Colonel Ellet himself did not come ashore. The only Federal casualty of the engagement, he had been pinked in the knee by a pistol ball while waving his hat on the hurricane deck of his flagship, directing the ram attack. The wound, though painful, was not considered dangerous. Prone on the deck, he continued in command throughout the fight. But infection set in, and he died of it 2 weeks later while being taken north aboard one of the rams. Before his death, however, he had the satisfaction of proving his theory in action, and of knowing that his genius, in conjunction with the no doubt larger genius of that other civil engineer, James Eads, had cleared the Mississippi down to Vicksburg, whose batteries now would be grist for Davis's and Farragut's upper and nether millstones. At Tupelo, where he called a halt 52 miles south of Corinth, Beauregard was infuriated by Halleck's widely circulated dispatch, which glorified Pope at the Creole's expense, by claiming a large bag of demoralized prisoners and abandoned equipment. He hotly replied, through the columns of newspapers guilty of spreading this libel, that the report contained as many lies as lines. Far from being a rout, he said, or even a reverse, the retreat was conducted with great order and precision, doing much credit to the officers and men under my orders, and must be looked upon in every respect by the country as equivalent to a brilliant victory. Not all of his own countrymen agreed with him, any more than Halleck's had agreed with Halleck, but in the Southerners' case, the dissenters included the chief executive. While the army was falling back, exposing his home state and the river down its western flank to deeper penetration, Davis told his wife, "If Mississippi troops lying in camp, when not retreating under Beauregard, were at home, they would probably keep a section of the river free for our use and closed against Yankee transports." The general had been sent west to help recover territory, not surrender more, and when it became evident after Shiloh that this was not to be accomplished, an intimate of the Davis circle wrote prophetically in her diary in reference to the hero of Sumter and Manassas, "Cock Robin is as dead as he ever will be now. What matters it who killed him?" As if in confirmation, soon after the loss of Memphis and its covering flotilla opened the river south to Vicksburg, the Tupelo commander received from the adjutant general in Richmond a telegraphic warning that trouble was brewing for him there. "The president has been expecting a communication explaining your last movement. It has not yet arrived." Beauregard replied, "Have had no time to write report. Busy organizing and preparing for battle if pursued. Retreat was a most brilliant and successful one," he added, maneuvering for solid ground on which to meet objections, now that he had begun to see that the hoax might seem less fruitful and amusing from a distance. Next day, June 13th, he forwarded a complete report, enclosing a clipping from the Chicago Tribune which showed that the enemy, at least, admired his generalship. He ended with a prediction that Halleck would find Corinth a barren locality which he must abandon as wholly worthless for his purposes. If the document lacked his usual verve, there were more reasons than the melancholia resulting from lack of appreciation from above. Though the army's health was improving rapidly in the more salubrious Tupelo surroundings, the general's own was not. He had never entirely recovered from the throat operation he had undergone in Virginia, and the strain of long-odds campaigning had lowered his resistance even more. For months his doctors had been urging him to take a rest. Always he had replied that the military crisis would not permit it. But now that his army was out of contact with the enemy, he thought he might safely go to Bladen Springs, a resort north of Mobile, for a week or 10 days of rest and relaxation, before returning to take up the reins again. Bragg, the next-ranking general, could hold them in his absence. Beauregard considered him fully qualified, having recommended him for the position just after Shiloh. Armed with a certificate of disability from his medical director, he was packing to leave on the 14th when he learned that Bragg had received, clean over his commander's head, a War Department order instructing him to assume command of the Vicksburg defenses. Angry at having been bypassed, Beauregard wired that Bragg could not be spared. He himself was taking a short sick leave, he said, and was leaving the North Carolinian in charge of the army during his absence. Then, as if suddenly aware that this was the first he had told the authorities of his intended departure, he wrote a letter describing his run-down physical condition, quoting his doctor's insistence that he take a rest and giving his travel schedule. He did not ask permission to go, he simply told the government he was going. Nor did he send the information by wire, he sent it by regular mail, and was on his way to Bladen Springs before the letter got to Richmond. Bragg considered his position awkward, knowing the trouble that was brewing, and with regular army prudence wired Richmond for instructions as soon as his chief was gone. The reaction was immediate, perhaps because the wire arrived on the same day as news of another consequence of the retreat, the fall of Cumberland Gap. As far as Davis was concerned, the situation at Tupelo spoke for itself. Beauregard was AWOL. Accordingly, a telegram went to Bragg at once, assigning him to permanent command. The Creole first learned of the action from a telegram Bragg sent to intercept him in Mobile. "I envy you and am almost in despair," Bragg said. Beauregard replied, "I cannot congratulate you, but am happy for the change." He was not happy. He just said that to cover his anger and disappointment. 4 months ago, he had come west full of resentment at having been shunted away from the main field of endeavor into a vaster but relatively much less important theater. Since then, he had learned better. The war was to be won or lost as readily here as in the east. What was more, he had come to respect and love the Western Army, just as it loved and respected him. And he was bitter against the man who had taken it from him as abruptly as if by a pull on the trigger of a pistol already leveled at his head. Replying to a letter of sympathy sent by a friend, he wrote, "If the country be satisfied to have me laid on the shelf by a man who is either demented or a traitor to his high trust, well, let it be so. I require rest and will endeavor meanwhile by study and reflection to fit myself for the darkest hours of our trial, which I foresee are yet to come." Part, at least, of the study and reflection was devoted to composing other phrases which he considered descriptive of the enemy who had wronged him. "That living specimen of gall and hatred," he called Davis now. "That individual." Chapter 5. Fighting Means Killing. Disaster came in various forms this spring, and it moved to various tempos. In the west it came like fireworks, looming after a noisy rush and casting a lurid glow. Whole states, whole armies fell at once or had large segments broken off by the tread of the invader. Kentucky and Missouri, most of Tennessee, much of Arkansas, North Alabama, and North Mississippi were lost in rapid succession, along with 30,000 fighting men, dead or in northern prison camps. And finally, New Orleans, Memphis, and the fleets that had been built, or worse, were being built, to hold the river that ran between them. That was how it reached the west. In the east, it came otherwise, not with a gaudy series of eruptions and collapses and attendant pillars of fire, but with a sort of inexorable hover, an inching forward through mist and gloom, as if it were conserving energy for an even more spectacular climax, the collapse of the national capital, the destruction of the head and front of government itself. On damp evenings, such as the one that fell on May Day, the grumble of McClellan's guns at Yorktown, faintly audible from Richmond's hills, reached listeners through what seemed to them the twilight of the gods. Nowhere, east or west, had there been a victory to celebrate since Ball's Bluff in October 7 months ago. Foreign intervention, the cure-all formally assured by early spring because that was when England's cotton reserves were supposed to be exhausted, now seemed further away than ever. "There are symptoms that the Civil War cannot very long be protracted," the once friendly London Times was saying. "Let its last embers burn down to the last spark without being trodden out by our feet." Confederates could tell themselves they had known all along that the English had never made a habit of retrieving other people's chestnuts. But additional, less deniable disappointments loomed much nearer. Although the near exhaustion of the nation's war supplies, especially powder, was kept secret, other effects of the naval blockade were all too well known. After a disastrous attempt at price control was abandoned, the regulated items having simply disappeared from grocery shelves, prices went up with a leap. Meat was 50 cents a pound, butter 75 cents, coffee $1.50, and tea $10, all in contrast to cotton, which had fallen to 5 cents. Salt, Lot's wife in the slang of the day, was scarce after the loss of the Kanawha works, and sugar went completely out of sight with the news of the fall of New Orleans. What was more, all this took place in an atmosphere not only of discouragement, but also of suspicion. Treasonable slogans were being chalked on fences and walls. Union men to the rescue. Now is the time to rally round the old flag. God bless the stars and stripes. There were whispers of secret and mysterious union meetings, and one morning a black coffin was found, suggestively near the executive mansion, a noosed rope coiled on its lid. Few citizens approved of the coffin threat, but many approved of its implication as to where the blame for their present troubles lay. And so did a number of their elected representatives. The permanent Congress was different from the one that had come to Richmond from Montgomery, not so much in composition, however, as in outlook. Though for the most part they were the same men, re-elected, they served under different circumstances, the bright dawn having given way to clouds. A member who had resigned to enter the army, but who kept in touch with his former colleagues, told his wife, "It seems that things are coming to this pass. To be a patriot, you must hate Davis." They took their cue from R.B. Rhett, whose Charleston Mercury was saying, "Jefferson Davis now treats all men as if they were idiotic insects." One among them who felt that way was Yancey. Back from his fruitless European mission, he was angrily demanding to know why Virginia had 29 generals and Alabama only 4. Another was Tom Cobb, who wrote home that he and his fellows were secretly debating the deposition of Davis. "He would be deposed," Cobb declared, "if the Congress had any more confidence in Stevens than in him." If they could not get rid of him, they could at least try the next best thing by limiting his powers, especially in the conduct of military affairs. This had been the basis for the virulent attack on Benjamin, who administered the War Department under the close supervision of his chief. Reasoning that a professional soldier would be less pliant, they attempted to oust Benjamin by recommending R.E. Lee for the position. When Davis refused to make the change on grounds that the law required a civilian at the post, Congress retaliated with an act calling for the appointment of a commanding general who would have full authority to take charge of any army in the field whenever he thought best. Davis vetoed the measure as a violation of his rights as commander-in-chief, but at the same time, it was early March by then, ordered Lee to duty at the seat of government, where he would be charged with the conduct of military operations under the direction of the president. Thus Davis frustrated his enemies in Congress. He gained a military secretary, an orderly sergeant, one newspaper sneered, without sacrificing one jot of his constitutional prerogative. Lee saw well enough what it came to. Returning to Richmond from his work on the South Atlantic coastal defenses, he observed, "I cannot see either advantage or pleasure in my duties, but I will not complain, but do the best I can." His best was better than might have been expected, considering the limitations of his authority and his early failures in the field. Mainly what he accomplished was done through tactful handling of the president, whose admission that "events have cast on our arms and hopes the gloomiest shadows," Lee now saw it firsthand, was the mildest possible statement of conditions. Not only was there a crippling shortage of weapons, it now appeared probable that there soon would be a lack of men to shoulder the few they had. The so-called bounty and furlough law, having proved a failure, except as a disruptive influence, few of the volunteers whose Sumter-inspired one-year enlistments would expire in April seemed willing to forego at least a vacation at home before signing up again, and many were saying quite openly that they were through with army life for good. In the heat of their conviction that they had earned a rest, the already badly outnumbered southern armies seemed likely to melt away, just as the northern juggernaut was scheduled to gather speed in the east as in the west. Virginia had already met the problem by providing for a general enrollment in the state militia of all citizens between the ages of 18 and 45, to be used as replacements for the men whose army enlistments expired. Under the influence of Lee, Davis proposed more stringent measures on a larger scale. In a late March message to Congress, he recommended outright conscription, within the same age bracket, throughout the Confederacy, To make sure, he said, that the burden of fighting did not fall exclusively on the most ardent and patriotic. Congress debated hotly, then on April 16th, after lowering the upper age limit to 35, passed the first national conscription law in American history. They passed it because they knew it was necessary, but they blamed Davis for having made it necessary by adopting the dispersed defensive, which they said had dampened national enthusiasm. His reply, that without military stores, without the workshops to create them, without the power to import them, necessity, not choice, has compelled us to occupy strong positions and everywhere to confront the enemy without reserves, did nothing to assuage the anger of the state's writers, who saw in conscription a repudiation of the principles for which the war was being fought. Georgia's governor, Joseph E. Brown, flatly declared that no act of the government of the United States prior to the secession of Georgia struck a blow at constitutional liberty so fell as has been struck by the Conscription Act. The fire-eaters, already furious at having been denied high offices, renewed their attacks on Davis as a despot. He replied in a letter to a friend, "When everything is at stake and the united power of the South alone can save us, it is sad to know that men can deal in such paltry complaints and tax their ingenuity to slander because they are offended in not getting office. If we can achieve our independence, the office seekers are welcome to the one I hold." However, the critics were in full bay now and were not to be turned aside by scorn or reason. Ominously, they pointed out that Napoleon's rise to absolute power had been accomplished by just such an act of conscription. Nothing Davis said or did was above suspicion. Even his turning to the solace of religion, up till now he had never been a formal member of any church, was seen as a possibly sinister action. "The president is thin and haggard," a War Department clerk observed in mid-April, "and it has been whispered that he will immediately be baptized and confirmed. I hope so, because it may place a great gulf between him and the descendant of those who crucified the Savior." Nevertheless, some of his enemies allege that professions of Christianity have sometimes been the premeditated accompaniments of usurpation. It was so with Cromwell and Richard III. The descendant referred to, of course, was the clerk's former department chief, Benjamin, now head of the State Department. He was as skillful an administrator as ever, but the problems here were not the kind that could be solved by rapid pigeonholing. Europe was reacting to the news of Union successes along the line of the Mississippi, and that reaction worked strongly against Confederate recognition. Slidell was beginning to weary of the French Emperor's slippery courtesies, which led to nothing above board or official, and Mason was suffering from the same feeling of affront that had vanquished Yancey. He wrote that he intended to present his next proposal for recognition as a demand of right, and if refused, as I have little doubt it would be, to follow the refusal by a note that I did not consider it compatible with the dignity of my government, and perhaps with my own self-respect, to remain longer in England. Benjamin's smile faded for once as he replied, imploring Mason not to act rashly. His mere presence in London was of enormous value. He must await eventualities. Fortunately, the Virginian had not acted on his impulse, but his patience was wearing thin, and this was one more worry that had to be passed along to Davis. He had tried to steel his harrowed nerves against the criticisms flung at him from all sides, telling his wife, "I wish I could learn just to let people alone who snap at me, in forbearance and charity to turn away as well as from the cats as the snakes." But it was too much for him. He could approach his work with humility, but not his critics. When they snapped, he snapped back, nor was he highly skilled as an arbitrator. He had too much admiration and sympathy for those who would not yield, whatever their cause, to be effective at reconciling opponents. In fact, this applied to a situation practically in his own backyard. The White House stood on a tall hill, surrounded by other mansions. On the plain below were the houses of the poor, whose sons had formed a gang called the Butcher Cats, sworn to eternal hatred of the Hill Cats, the children of the gentry on the hill. The two gangs had rock fights and occasional gouging matches. After one particularly severe battle in which his oldest son was involved, Davis walked down the hill to try his hand at arbitration. He made them a speech referring to the Butcher Cats as future leaders of the nation. One of them replied, "President, we like you. We don't want to hurt any of your boys, but we ain't never going to be friends with them hill cats." Davis came back up the hill. Everywhere Lee had been in this war, he had arrived to find disaster looming ready-made, and this was no exception. Militarily, as well as politically, the mid-March outlook in Virginia was bleak indeed. Federal combinations totaling well over 200,000 men were threatening less than 70,000 Confederates, strung out along an arc whose cord extended northwest-southeast through Richmond. At the lower end, Huger held Norfolk with 13,000, threatened from below by Burnside with the same number. Down near the tip of the York James Peninsula, Major General John B. Magruder's 12,000 were entrenched in front of Fort Monroe and its garrison of the same number. Northward, after retreating to their new position at Fredericksburg and along the near bank of the Rapidan, Johnston's 37,000 had been followed as far as Manassas by McClellan, who had 175,000 effectives in and out of the Washington defenses. Both main armies, the Army of Northern Virginia, as Lee now began to style it, and the Army of the Potomac, had detachments in the Shenandoah Valley, where Jackson with 5,000 was falling back before Major General Nathaniel P. Banks with twice as many. Finally, at the upper or western end of this long arc, beyond Stanton, a little force of 2,800 under Brigadier General Edward Johnson prepared to do what it could to block Fremont's proposed descent of the Alleghenies with McClellan's old army of 12,500, which in time would be doubled, despite McClellan's protests, by accretions from his new one. Much of this was unknown to Lee, especially enemy strengths, which in general were overestimated. The Confederate spy system was yielding very little information these days. But one thing was quite clear. After leaving a sizable garrison to hold the Washington entrenchments, McClellan's large main body could slide anywhere along that arc, or rather under cover just beyond it, then bull straight through for Richmond, outnumbering 3-1, or for that matter 10-1, depending on where it struck, any force that stood in its path. Just now its actions were suspicious. After following Johnston's army as far as Manassas, it turned mysteriously back and re-entered the cordon of forts around the northern capital. This seemed to indicate that it was about to start its slide, but before Lee could even begin to try to second-guess its destination, news arrived from the south that upset his already inadequate dispositions. Burnside had taken New Bern. This was a challenge that had to be met, for he was now within 60 miles of Richmond's only direct rail connection with the South Atlantic states. Lee met it in the only way he could, by weakening what was far too weak already. Detaching several regiments from Huger at Norfolk and two brigades from Johnston's right wing at Fredericksburg, he sent them south into North Carolina under Major General Theophilus Holmes, a native of the threatened area. The following week, March 23rd, Stonewall Jackson turned on Banks at Kernstown, intending to inflict a terrible wound on what he thought was a small segment, but soon retreated, badly cut up himself, when the segment turned out to be a full division. One more defeat was added to the growing list, though the news was less discouraging than it might have been, arriving as it did on the heels of more disturbing information. Just as Lee returned to giving the main danger, McClellan, his main attention, Huger reported by telegraph that more than 20 transports had come down Chesapeake Bay the night before and were disembarking troops at Old Point Comfort across the way. Soon afterward, this alarming news was confirmed by a wire from Magruder calling urgently for reinforcements. The force confronting him, he said, had risen to 35,000 overnight. Neither general identified the enemy units, but Lee considered their arrival a probable sign that McClellan had started his slide along the arc. However, even if Lee had been certain of this, he still could not be certain of their goal. They might be on their way to Burnside for operations in North Carolina. They might be mounting an offensive against Norfolk. They might be intended as a diversion to hold Magruder in position while the main body jumped on Johnston. Or they might be the advance of McClellan's whole army arriving for an all-out drive up the peninsula. Until he knew which of these possibilities was, or were, at least probable, he would be taking an enormous risk in strengthening the arc at any point by weakening it at another. To lose Norfolk, for example, would be to lose the Virginia, which was all that was keeping the federal gunboats from wrecking Magruder's right flank on their way up the James to bombard Richmond. Or to weaken Johnston's army, already reduced by more than 10% as a result of detaching the two brigades for Holmes, might be to expose that mainstay of the Confederate defense to utter destruction. While awaiting further indications, Lee warned Huger and Magruder to be ready for mutual assistance, one to reinforce the other as soon as events showed which was the federal objective, Norfolk or Yorktown. Meanwhile, the water batteries along the James were strengthened, particularly the ones at Drury's Bluff, 8 miles below Richmond, and the city's scant reserves, 2 regiments of infantry and some odd squadrons of cavalry, were dispatched to Magruder, who was told to put on as brave a show as possible in the face of the build-up at Fort Monroe. If it became necessary to give ground, he was told to yield it stubbornly, fighting all the way to the gates of the city, 60 miles in his rear. Magruder answered excitedly that a council of war held the night before had voted to evacuate Yorktown unless 10,000 reinforcements were sent to him at once. Lee replied that councils of war were always timid in such situations, then repeated his instructions. Keep up a bold front, and yield nothing except to absolute pressure. He would send him what he could. Whatever he sent him would have to come from Johnston, who had already expressed his unwillingness to furnish any more troops for other commanders. He would bring his whole army down, if ordered, but he was opposed to piecemeal reinforcement as a violation of sound principles. Concentration, not dispersal, was the answer, he declared. He could spare 2 more brigades, another 10% of his original force, but that was all. Lee took them, duly thankful for small favors, sent 1 to Magruder, salving his anxiety a bit, and 1 to Holmes, hoping thus to keep Burnside out of the squeeze play, and then proceeded to exercise on the touchy Johnston the same tact and delicacy he was using simultaneously in his dealings with Davis, who was quite as touchy. Light Horse Harry Lee and Peter Johnston had soldiered together in the First Revolution. Now their sons worked together in the Second. During the 10 days between March 24th, when the arrival of the transports was reported, and April 4th, Lee managed by gradual detachment to transfer 3 of Johnston's 6 divisions from the Rapidan to the James. By the latter date, the Army of Northern Virginia, exclusive of Jackson out in the valley, had been reduced to 23,000, while Magruder had 31,500 troops either with him or on the way. They were in capable hands and well employed. If Magruder was high-strung and over-imaginative by ordinary standards, it presently developed that these qualities, so doubtful in a military leader, could be positive advantages in an extraordinary situation, such as the one that involved him now. A 52-year-old Virginian, tall and flamboyantly handsome, with a great shock of dark hair, bushy sideburns, and a large but carefully barbered mustache, Prince John, he had been called in the old army. He spoke with a lisp, except when he sang in a clear tenor, as he often did, songs of his own composition. That had been his greatest spare-time pleasure, staging concerts and amateur theatricals, in which he took a leading role to relieve the tedium of peacetime garrison duty. Now he had a chance to exercise his talents on a larger scale and for a more deadly purpose. Exploiting to the full Lee's admonition to show a brave front to the heavily reinforced enemy, he staged an extravaganza with a cast of thousands, playing, as it were, to a packed house. He bristled aggressively whenever he imagined a Yankee spyglass trained in his direction, shifting his artillery from point to point along his line and firing noisily at anything in sight. No wheeze was too old for Magruder to employ it. One morning he sent a column along a road that was heavily wooded except for a single gap in plain view of the enemy outposts. All day the gray files swept past in seemingly endless array, an army gathering in thousands among the pines for an offensive. They were no such thing, of course. Like a low-budgeted theatrical director producing the effect with an army of supernumeraries, Magruder was marching a single battalion round and around, past the gap, then around undercover, and past the gap again. He had the men working as well as parading. The buskin was supplementary to the spade. Utilizing the old British earthworks around Yorktown, moldering since the days of the Revolution, they dug furiously down to the Warwick River, which was dammed near its mouth and at several points upstream, to create an intermittent moat in front of the high ground leading southward to the James. This was the first peninsular line, 14 miles in length, a great deal too long for the number of men available to defend it. Its principal drawback, however, was that the flanks were open to naval bombardment if the Union warships decided to brave the Virginia on the right or the additional water battery on the left across the York at Gloucester Point. 10 miles in his rear, just east of Williamsburg, Magruder was constructing a second defensive line, though in fact it was not so much a line as it was a sort of rally point in case the first gave way. Here he had two streams to protect his flanks from infantry assault, one flowing north, the other south. On the high ground in the center, just in front of the old colonial capital, he was improvising a bastioned earthwork which he or his officers, after the thespian custom of sometimes naming a theater for a star, christened Fort Magruder. This second peninsular line had all the drawbacks of the first, plus certain intrinsic weaknesses all its own. Magruder was not a skilled engineer. He admitted it and even complained about it. But he tried to make up in energy for what he lacked in skill. A dozen small redoubts were scattered about for the fort's protection. Fields of fire were cleared by felling trees. Additional rifle pits were dug, extending the line behind the tidal creeks. Magruder was doing the best he could. In case that best was not enough, which seemed likely considering the odds and limitations, Lee had a third line under construction, 40 miles behind the second and within 10 miles of Richmond. Its right was anchored on the James and its left on the Chickahominy, a boggy stream which also covered a portion of the front with a tributary known as White Oak Swamp. This was the strongest of the three peninsular lines, being immune from naval attack, but Lee did not want to use it until he had to. Resistance below would give him time to bring up whatever troops he could spare from other points and to complete the reorganization now in progress while Congress debated conscription. That was why he was sending all the men he could lay hands on, including half of Johnston's army, down to Yorktown. For a time, he feared that he had guessed wrong. The Federals were strangely inactive at Fort Monroe. Then on April 4th, he received word from Jeb Stuart, on outpost duty north of the Rappahannock, that another relay of transports was on its way down the Potomac. Simultaneously, Magruder reported heavy blue columns moving in his direction. These two pieces of evidence were strong, but Lee was still not sure that this was McClellan's main effort. Then, 5 days later, on the heels of the depressing news that Albert Sidney Johnston had fallen at Shiloh, a minister who had escaped from Alexandria gave a detailed account of Unionist activities at that port of embarkation, adding that he personally had seen McClellan himself board one of the steamers for the journey down the coast. For Lee, this was conclusive. He went to Davis with the evidence, and that same day, April 9th, the president ordered Johnston to report at once to Richmond, bringing his two strongest divisions along for duty on the peninsula. He arrived on the 12th. Two of his divisions, under Major Generals G.W. Smith and Longstreet, were in his wake. The third, under Major General Ewell, stayed where it was, with instructions to cooperate with Jackson if the necessity arose. Informed that his command now included the peninsula and Norfolk, Johnston left Richmond that same day for an inspection of the Yorktown and Williamsburg lines. 2 mornings later, April 14th, he was back again, waiting in the presidential office when Davis arrived for work. The bleakness of his outlook matched the brevity of his absence. Both of Magruder's defensive lines were utterly untenable, he told Davis. Not only were they improperly sighted and too long, vulnerable as they were to artillery in front and amphibious landings in the rear, they would most likely prove a trap for any army that tried to hold them. In short, he favored an immediate withdrawal to the third line of defense. Davis, somewhat taken aback at this suggestion that the war be brought forthwith to the gates of Richmond, asked the general to return at 11 a.m. and present his views to Lee and Secretary Randolph. This being the case, Johnston asked that Smith and Longstreet also be invited, thus to preserve the balance. Davis agreed. When the six men assembled at the specified hour, it was evident that the general had chosen his supporters wisely. Longstreet had won considerable renown as a poker player, but had given it up 3 months ago on the eve of his 41st birthday, when his three children died of scarlet fever all within a week. Grief had given him a stolid and ponderous dignity, augmented by a slight deafness which he could sit behind when he chose, as behind a wall of soundproof glass. He chose to sit so now. A large, square-built, hairy man, a native of the Deep South, born in South Carolina, raised in Georgia, and appointed to West Point from Alabama. He left the talking to Smith, who was a year younger but had been trained for disputation as street commissioner of New York City. Like Mansfield Lovell, his New York deputy, Smith had joined the Confederacy late, after waiting to see what his native Kentucky would do. 2 months after Manassas, he made his choice, which Davis applauded by making him a major general and giving him a division under Johnston, who admired him. The two were Joe and G.W. to each other. A big-framed man with a large nose and firm-set lips, a West Pointer and a Mexico veteran, a former assistant professor of engineering at the Academy, Smith had been a civilian for the past 8 years and was quite accustomed to attending such high-level councils as this. With Davis's and Johnston's permission, he said, he would like to submit a memorandum he had prepared. Johnston looked it over, then passed it to Davis, who read it aloud. It was as if the ghost of Beauregard had been transported eastward 700 airline miles from Mississippi. What Smith proposed, in essence, was a withdrawal from Norfolk and the Lower Peninsula, a concentration of all available troops, and then a sudden strike either against McClellan as he came up, or against the northern heartland beyond the Potomac. Smith was convinced that the fast-marching Southern Army could occupy Philadelphia or New York before McClellan could take Richmond. Johnston, questioned by Randolph, said he agreed, up to a point. He was not anxious to march on New York, but he did want to cripple McClellan, and this was the way to do it. Norfolk and Yorktown were untenable anyhow. Randolph, a former Navy man, protested that the loss of Gosport Navy Yard would mean the loss of the Virginia, which could neither put to sea nor ascend the James, unseaworthy and deep-drafted as she was, as well as the loss of all hope of ever building a real Confederate fleet. Johnston replied that it could not be helped. To attempt to hold positions that could readily be flanked would be to invite the destruction not only of the future Navy, but also of the present Army. All day the discussion continued, Randolph and Lee against Johnston and Smith, with Longstreet saying little and Davis acting as moderator. At supper time they recessed for an hour, then reassembled at the Executive Mansion, where the argument continued into the night, apparently without affecting the convictions of any of the six. Then at 1 a.m. Davis adjourned the meeting with the decision to hold both Norfolk and Yorktown by uniting Johnston's and Magruder's armies on the Lower Peninsula, under instructions to resist all federal attempts to advance. Johnston thus was being sent to defend a position which he had declared untenable. He would have been removed, Davis later wrote, except that he did not ask to be, and I had no wish to separate him from troops with whom he was so intimately acquainted. Johnston had his reasons, though he did not give them then. The belief that events on the peninsula would soon compel the Confederate government to adopt my method of opposing the Federal Army, he wrote later, reconciled me somewhat to the necessity of obeying the President's order. As the general returned to Yorktown, convinced that things would work out his way in the end, Longstreet's men were marching through Richmond to join him. The Walking Division, they called themselves, and one of them grumbled, "I suppose that if it was intended to reinforce Savannah, Mobile, or New Orleans with our division, we would be compelled to foot it all the way." But now that they were nearing the end of the march, their spirits rose. It was the anniversary of Virginia's secession, and the whole city had turned out to greet them with cheers and armloads of early spring flowers. Jonquils, hyacinths, narcissuses, and violets were tossed and caught, looped into wreaths or stuck into rifle muzzles. The drab, mud-stained column seemed to burst into bloom as it swung down Main Street, a riot of colors dominated by the bright, nodding yellow of the jonquils. Bands played Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag, and the men returned the cheers of the crowd along the way. At one window they saw a lady and a pale young man waving handkerchiefs, and one of the bearded veterans shouted, "Come right along, sonny, the lady'll spare you. Here's a little musket for you." The answer came back, "All right, boys, have you got a leg for me, too?" As he spoke, he placed on the windowsill the stump of the leg he had lost at Manassas. The battalion made an effective apology. Wheeling spontaneously into line, it halted, presented arms, and rattled the windows of the block with cheering. Johnston found a quite different spirit around Yorktown, 50 miles below. Magruder and his men were worn out by the strain of the long bluff. Their food was poor and their uniforms in rags. What was more, the enemy had begun to probe the Warwick River line with field artillery. There were night alarms and occasional stampedes, one including a work party of several hundred slaves who broke for the rear and in their flight swept away part of the infantry support. Whatever his vaunted gallantry in the open field, the Southern volunteer did not relish this kind of warfare, huddling under bombardments and waiting to be overrun. One detachment gave way completely under the tension, a member of the relief party reporting that he had found some of these poor lads sobbing in their broken sleep, like a crying child just before it sinks to rest. It was really pathetic. The men actually had to be supported to the ambulances sent down to bring them away. They had the sympathy of their new commander, who was convinced that they should not have stayed there in the first place. To the War Department, the last 10 days of April brought word of the fall of New Orleans and the opening of Halleck's campaign against Corinth, as well as a trickle of I-told-you-so dispatches from the Lower Peninsula. Johnston declared that Magruder's lines were even more defective than he had supposed when he made his first inspection. "No one but McClellan could have hesitated to attack," he reported on the 22nd, and urged that some bridges across the Chickahominy, 20-odd miles in his rear, should be repaired at once. 2 days later, he was suggesting that supplies be sent to meet the army on its way to the gates of the city in the event of our being compelled to fall back from this point. On the 27th, he instructed UG to prepare to evacuate Norfolk. 2 days later, he wrote to Lee in the plainest language he had yet employed, "The fight for Yorktown, as I said in Richmond, must be one of artillery in which we cannot win. The result is certain, the time only doubtful. We must abandon the peninsula at once." There they had it. He had been right all along. May Day was a time of gloom in the southern capital. Ball's Bluff seemed far away and long ago. One source of consolation existed, but it was unknown in Richmond, being hidden in the fog of war, far down the James and beyond the enemy lines. Johnston's worries were balanced, more than balanced, at least in number, by the woes of his opponent, which differed as much in quality as they did in multiplicity. The Southern commander's fretfulness was based almost exclusively on strictly tactical considerations, the weakness of the Yorktown defenses and the shortage of troops to man them. But McClellan's was the product of a variety of pressures, roughly divisible under three main headings. 1, downright bad luck. 2, Lincoln. And, as always, 3, his own ripe imagination. The first of a rapid succession of blows, like the preliminary tap of a farrier taking aim, landed the moment he stepped off the steamer at Old Point Comfort. Flag Officer Goldsborough, up from the North Carolina Sounds to provide naval support for the movement up the narrow tongue of land, met him with word that the fleet would not be able to assist in reducing the enemy batteries on the York or the James. The Navy already had its hands full, he said, patrolling Hampton Roads to neutralize the Merrimack, Virginia. One of the primary conditions of success, as stated by the Corps commanders on the eve of departure, thus was removed before the campaign had even begun. Fortunately, McClellan had a full day in which to absorb the shock of this, but after that brief respite, the blows began to land with trip-hammer rapidity. On the second day, April 4th, as he started his army forward, much gratified by the wonderfully cool performance of the trio of foragers who brought him the still-warm 12-pound shot, he made 2 dreadful discoveries. The first was that his handsome coastal survey maps were woefully inaccurate. The roads all ran the wrong way, he complained, and the Warwick River, shown on the maps as an insignificant creek flowing parallel to the James, was in fact a considerable barrier, cutting squarely across his line of march. To add to its effectiveness as an obstacle, the Confederates had dammed it in 5 places, creating 5 unwadable lakes and training their heavy artillery on the boggy intervals. McClellan was amazed at the river's location and condition. "It grows worse the more you look at it," he wailed. As he stood gazing forlornly at this waste of wetness in his path, another unexpected development overtook him, also involving water. It began to rain, and from this there grew an even worse disclosure. Those fine sandy roads, recommended as being passable at all seasons on the year, turned out to be no such thing. What they were was gumbo, and they were apparently bottomless. Guns and wagons bogged past the axles, then sat there, immovably stuck. One officer later testified that he saw a mule go completely out of sight in one of the chunk holes, all but the tips of its ears, but added, in the tall-tale tradition, that the mule was a rather small one. No navy, no fit maps, no transportation. McClellan might well have thought the fates had dealt him all the wheel they intended. Writing to his wife of his unenviable position, "The rebels on one side and the abolitionists and other scoundrels on the other," he said, "Don't worry about the wretches. They have done nearly their worst and can't do much more." He was wrong, and before the day was over, he would discover just how wrong he was. The people he referred to could do a great deal more. If McClellan did not realize this, Lincoln's 2 young secretaries knew it quite well already. "General McSee is in danger," one was telling the other. "Not in front, but in rear." Returning to Army headquarters at the close of that same busy day, his first in bristling proximity to the enemy since the campaign in West Virginia, almost 9 months ago, McClellan found the atmosphere of the lantern-hung interior as glum as the twilight landscape of rain-soaked fields and dripping woods through which he had just ridden. Sorrow and anger, despair and incredulity were strangely combined on the faces of his staff. Soon the young Napoleon was sharing these mixed emotions, for the answer, or answers, lay in a batch of orders and directives just off the wire from Washington. The first was dated yesterday, April 3rd. Fort Monroe and its garrison of 12,000, placed under McClellan 2 weeks ago as a staging area and a pool from which to draw replacements, were removed forthwith from his control. Before he could recover from the shock of learning that he had lost not only that number of troops, but also command of his present base of operations, he was handed a second order, more drastic than the first. McDowell's corps of 38,000 still awaiting sailing orders at Alexandria. McClellan intended to bring it down in mass as soon as he decided where to land it, whether on the south bank of the York for operations against Yorktown, or on the north bank against Gloucester Point, was detached and withheld as part of the force assigned to provide close-in protection for the capital. This action was given emphasis by a supplementary order creating what was called the Department of the Rappahannock under McDowell, as well as another new one called the Department of the Shenandoah under Banks, whose corps was also declared no longer a part of the Army of the Potomac. McClellan was floored. Even without the loss of Banks, which made no actual change in dispositions, the combined detachments of Blenker, McDowell, and the Fort Monroe garrison, an approximate total of 60,000 fighting men, reduced by well over one-third the 156,000 he had said at the outset would be necessary for the success of his peninsula campaign. Nor was this all. As he took to his troubled bed that night, he had something else to think about, something that seemed to him and his staff conclusive proof that the administration, disapproving of the campaign in the first place, was determined to assure its failure before the opening shot was fired. A final order, dated yesterday and signed by the Adjutant General for distribution to the governors of all the loyal states,